Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. Happy holidays, everybody. We are still talking about the NBA, which is crackling, even though it's bowl season. Joining us from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, where he just saw, by the way, it's Wednesday afternoon for Mr. Bontemps, Wednesday morning for me. And Mr. Bontemps, you were at the Clippers-Raptors game. You are in Toronto for this week. Hello, Mr. Tim Bontemps.
Hello. Before we started the podcast, McMahon asked me, is that a river next to Toronto? And I said, no, that's a great lake. So it shows you, where we're at with geography class.
It's a great, lake.
Listen, I didn't know they had lakes in Canada.
That's that's our man from Texas, Stan McMahon.
Howdy, partners, and mahalo.
Before we...
How's that for some culture?
Well, mahalo means thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, there you go. Bontemps, real quick, before we talk about the game that McMahon was at Tuesday night, which may or may not have been seen by our average NBA fans, I was reading about the game you were at where the Clippers have been playing better, got the win, and it said that Norm Powell picked up his championship ring. That was what it said in there. Do you know, but did he really not had his championship ring until now?
I didn't talk to Norm last night because I was doing some other interviews, but I believe it was at his place here.
But he just hadn't been to his place here.
I don't think he'd been home because he got traded. He got traded during the season when they were in Tampa. And he hadn't played a game here since, I think, February of 2020, because they went on a long road trip before pandemic. Okay. And then they played in Tampa after the bubble, and then he got traded. So this is the first time he'd been back here since then.
I wouldn't call it his home then. It's
still has a place there?
Well,
hopefully it's an Airbnb or something.
I mean, maybe the Raptors had it. Maybe the Raptors had it. I'm not sure, but it seemed like he got it from his place.
Okay, good. That makes more sense to me All right. Never mind. Moving onward. McMahon, what happened in Dallas last night? Can I just say that Luka's performance, like, it'll be one of those games that people always remember. And that's what we're going to talk about. But like, had the Knicks won that game, it would have been like this amazingly awesome win for the Knicks. Jalen Brunson was out in his return game because of a sore hip. How far into the game did RJ Barrett hurt his finger?
I believe it was a minute and 36 seconds.
Okay.
Less than 2 minutes.
He's now going to be out for a number of games here. So he goes out. The Knicks play this tremendous game. They're on a losing streak. They need this win. They're absorbing already a big game from Luka. I want you to describe to me the moment in the arena, because SportsCenter replayed it about 13 times and about the sound in the building. If you could just, before we talk about the overall performance, the sound and everything in the building when he made that putback leaner runner, not runner, whatever it was, to force overtime.
Yeah, and so... Before he makes that, I'm sitting here thinking, oh my God, this guy is going to have a 50-point triple-double and lose, you know, which has happened before. But in NBA history, there have been 14 previous 50-point triple-doubles. Those guys were 13-1 in those games. It was about to be 13-2. And like, how often do you see, first of all, the fact that they were down 9 with 30 seconds left? 0-13,884 in the final 35 seconds.
Can you repeat that again, please, for the listeners, just to emphasize that?
Zero. This is over the last 20 years. And people say, what about the T-Mac game? Apparently they were down 8. 0-13,884. 13,884 over the last 20 years. Well, the Mavericks turned that 0 into a 1. Because Luka Doncic misses the free throw intentionally, and JaVale McGee, who had just checked into the game for the first time, specifically to try to somehow come up with the rebound on this, he's got two guys on him. You know, he's creating basically havoc under there. You know, Christian Wood's able to get a hand on it, goes off the hand of another Nick. Luka jumps up as high as he can, so almost like 6 inches in the air, grabs the ball, and before he hits the ground, just like flips it up. It goes in. He does this barrel roll. He gets up and starts chopping his feet, waving his hands, doing this wild ass dance.
He looked like my 5-year-old son at his birthday party a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it looked like the E Honda 1,000-hand slap from Street Fighter. That was what
And there's a classic picture of Luka doing this wild dance, and Tibbs is behind him with that Tibbs scout. Anyway, so there's a second left on the clock. The Knicks miss their, you know, their prayer, and Luka just storms to the other side of the court. He's got the biggest smile I've ever seen.
He was so happy.
Like, he's waving at the crowd, and he admitted after the game, he's like, I thought we'd won the game. He just got lost in the moment. Obviously, he knew the situation when he missed the free throw.
J.R. Smith avenged.
Well, he was smart enough to miss the free throw. So he knew the situation when he missed the free throw. But after he made it, he just got so caught up in what a miracle this was. And holy crap. By the way, that gave him 53 points, which tied the franchise record. He got so caught up in the moment, he'd forgotten. No, that just tied it up. He was celebrating a victory. And then he realizes that, whoa, there's overtime. As he said, the thought that crossed his mind at that point was, oof. Because this is a dude who, he rested 4 seconds in the second half, the final 4 seconds of overtime. And then he rested again, the final 4 seconds of the third quarter. And then he rested the final 8 seconds of overtime. So, but, you know, he goes on and over to, you know, he hits one of those. It was right by the Dirk silhouette, one of those off dribble Dirk one leggers, knocks down his free throws and over. They go on and win. He ends up with, you know, the numbers now, 60 points, 21 rebounds, 10 assists, the first 60-20-10 game in NBA history. You know, I asked Luke about his numbers, and he goes, 2 steals, 1 block, a jump ball too. He always wants the steals and blocks. Well, he always wants the steals and blocks. But
he did get 5 extra minutes of overtime to achieve those numbers. But
okay, sorry. At the end of regulation, he was only 53, 18, and 10.
I agree, but I just to point that out. But
so this, there's, I never thought I would see a more memorable regular season performance than Russell Westbrook's. I'm talking about live than Russell Westbrook's big O record breaking triple double. And that, if you'll remember, that was the game where it's in Denver. He gets
in the one on the MVP,
the one on the MVP. And he scored the last 13 points as the Thunder pull off this crazy comeback to get to 50 points and hits a buzzer beater from pretty close to half court that eliminated the Nuggets from the playoff. And the Pepsi Center crowd still instantaneously goes into this standing ovation. I never thought I would see a more memorable game than that. Man, this one ranks right up there. And Luka in the post game interview on the court with Skin Wade of the Mavs broadcast, also this week's guest on Howdy Partners, the hit YouTube show. Luka says, he says, it was smooth. He says, I'm tired as hell. And he goes, I need a recovery beer. So he had a recovery beer before he did his media availability. And my guess is he had, you know, several afterwards. He damn sure earned them.
Before you go, Bontemps, the rebound that Luka gets there is, first off, it's a friendly fire rebound from the Knicks. It reminded me
just a killer.
So
if you're a Knicks person,
so much of the Ray Allen shot where
just slightly lower stakes.
Slightly lower stakes a game in December.
Although every game right now feels pretty high stakes for the Mavericks.
Right. So, you know, that in that situation, Popovich famously didn't have Tim Duncan on the floor. And I think it was Boris Diaw and Ginobili, if my memory serves. But
JK got JaVale McGee out there. Pretty similar decision.
I know our man, Rob Perez, who was devastated, was furious that Tibbs didn't put in Isaiah Hartenstein. He was blaming it on that. But in that case, like I remember rewatching, I think it was Ginobili and Boris Diaw, but rewatching it like time after time and not understanding how the ball could have hit their two hands and come off and ended up in Bosch's hand. I couldn't compute.
If either Miles McBride or Quentin Grimes doesn't go for that rebound, just one of them does, the game's over. Yeah. But they both did, and so they both popped it up in the air, and you know the rest. But
it had to come up in the air, and just so that Luka could get it and shoot it. And the thing about Luka that's amazing is that his mastery with his ability to just he handles the ball like I would if I had like a 5 foot hoop and a mini ball, you know, and so that you could just you know manipulate the ball and that. Nothing mattered. Like the way Luka just maneuvers around, like he's probably never done anything like that, but because he's got such a mastery.
Any kind of crazy shot, Luka's probably tried it at some point. Like a normal catch and shoot three is when Luka is the least comfortable, but like let him go sit in the third row behind the basket and he's got a decent chance to hit that because he jacks around and takes those things on a regular basis and bets money on it and pads his salary.
Yeah, I mean, he plays basketball like a soccer player with the ball. Like, he does all these things. Like you said, Brian, like, there was a play last night when he dribbled in the lane and looked like he was going to go up to shoot it and then kind of just turned his hand this way and popped it out to Reggie Bullock for a three. And, like, there was nobody out. Everybody on the Knicks was like, oh, this guy's going up for a layup. They all crashed on him. And he just kind of – him and Jokic are similar that way. They do stuff with the ball where you just don't
– Yes, you just Jokic can't believe looks like where they're gonna he go has a – Jokic looks it's like he's polo. Yes. It looks like he's using a smaller ball than everybody else.
And it's just that vision. I'm telling you, like, I guess water polo is a huge sport in Serbia. I know he never played at a high level, but he has that vision where he sees, it's like he's got eyes all around his head. He sees everything. He's, you know,
we are going to talk about the Denver Nuggets in a minute.
Yeah.
Bontemps. That was the Mavericks' fourth straight win.
Get this for a stat. In those four wins, post-halftime, Luka has rested a total of 8 minutes and 13 seconds. And his post-halftime averages in this four-game win streak, this is, I'm wiping out the first and second quarter. 25.5 points, 8 rebounds, and 5.5 assists. Post-halftime averages. He's got a 50-point performance where he hit the dagger to beat the Rockets. Played all 24 minutes of the second half. A couple games later, 60, 21, and 10. Look, if you want to fun police it, if you want to USWB it, Bontemps, urine soaked wet blanket, then you can say, is this sustainable? How could he possibly keep this up? But it's insane to watch, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing for me is I couldn't watch this game last night because I'm in Toronto, so I don't have access to anything. And we were trying to pull it up at the arena and couldn't. So I was just following along both on my phone on the play-by-play and watching Twitter and having people text me about it. But, I mean, my thought, seen all the highlights. Luka was obviously unbelievable. My thought coming out of that game was just thinking about the Knicks. I mean, a week ago, the Knicks had won four games in a row. Life was great. They won eight games in a row. Life was great. They're up in like fifth place in the East. They're rolling along. All good vibes in New York. And since then, they give up 52 to Pascal Siakam and MSG and lose a close game. They have a horrific collapse against the Bulls in the final minute where Jalen Brunson and Quentin Grimes both miss two free throws. They failed to get an offensive rebound. They give up a DeMar DeRozan bucket with a second to go, lose that game. They lead pretty much the whole game against the Sixers on Sunday before they got out-talented by Joel Embiid and James Harden at the end. And then they have this game in Dallas where, you know, RJ leaves with a, I got an alert on my phone that RJ left with a finger laceration. I was like, what is going on here? That was 30 seconds into the game or whatever. Miles McBride plays 46 minutes off the bench. Tibbs might as well just leave Evan Fournier and Cam Reddish at home. They're never going to play again. And
there's a better chance of Kemba Walker playing for the Knicks again.
Yes, exactly. And like you said, Brian, they're on the verge of what would have been a massive win on the road against Luka, playing awesome. All this adversity against them, Julius Randle back home, would have been a huge win for the Knicks. Instead,
well, how about?
It's just another absolutely gut-wrenching loss. They've now lost four games in a row, and all the knives are back out in New York again. After everything was great a week ago,
they pretty much had all these teams in the whole league just dealing with injuries. The Knicks have basically not had injuries. So,
Until yesterday, their three guys, RJ Barrett, Jalen Brunson, and Julius Randle, have been healthy the entire season.
Right. So it's a little bit adverse. The other thing I'm going to say is my evaluation of the Knicks is that they are a 500 team. Yeah. And I think that they will end up with 41, 43, 39 wins. Mm-hmm. And so all roads, I think, are good. That's my opinion of them. They make a giant midseason trade and trade for someone. I won't say who, because then I'll get aggregated, but then I'll reevaluate. But my opinion, they're going to end up in that neighborhood. So it's weird to win eight and lose four or five, whatever it is now. But that's kind of who the Knicks are in my view.
How about poor Quentin Grimes, who
it's more
nice
just
young
the way
player.
They've lost. It's more just the way they've lost the game. I agree with with you on the stance of where they're at, but they've had some brutal losses this year. But yeah, go ahead. I mean,
yeah, you never want to be the one when there's a 5-digit number on the loss side.
Yeah.
But poor Quentin Grimes.
Veteran analysis.
You know, nice young player. And has the best game of his career shooting the balls, 33 points, open three after open three. Some of that was Luka's work, by the way. Anyways, but he's the primary defender on Luka, and they never trap. They never at some point get the ball out of his hands like everybody else does and make him play 4-on-3. Anyway,
but they were up 9 in the last minute.
I know.
That's the thing. What they did worked. It worked. So they just completely, lost the game at the last 30 seconds.
So Quentin Grimes, again, after he has a 33-point game, best shooting night of his career, all people ask him about is, dude, Luka lit you on fire. He said, I promise I was trying for sure. Trust me, it wasn't for lack of effort.
Yeah, Luka's lighting everybody on fire these days. We have an early trivia question if we're done with the Luka section.
All right. Go ahead.
Let's do it. Can we have a trivia question about which stats Joel Embiid leads Luka on?
Wins.
Does he actually lead him on wins?
Not actually in games they participated in this season, but go on. I know participation's a sensitive subject for Wendy.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So last night, Luka became the sixth player, or the sixth youngest player, to get to 8,000 points in his career. Who are the five guys that are ahead of him?
So I saw this stat.
I thought you might have seen it, but I looked in your story and I didn't see it. So I thought it would be.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stats in there. What are you
doing? There are a lot of stats.
Come on, good Lord of mercy.
No, I just, I just thought
next time I'll send it north of the border and let you see.
I just thought I just thought you might not have seen
this guy, Wendy.
Billion Luca stats.
I mean, thanks.
I just I was trying to find a Luca related trivia, and you didn't use this one, so I thought you might not have seen it amid all the Luca trivia last time.
Okay, so LeBron obviously is always in these things.
Well, because he got a head start. He got to start when he was 18. So when you're talking about youngest, you have to.
I believe Melo's in there.
Melo is in there. He's third.
So LeBron, Tracy McGrady, Melo. There's five, you say?
Yep. McGrady was
kind of cheating because I did see this, but I don't remember it. Is Booker one of those?
Booker is not.
Booker's not. He's close.
That would have been a good segue, but he is not.
Yeah. Other
These
guys.
Are questions.
Kobe's one.
Kobe's fourth.
So we're missing second.
There's one other player.
Probably got to be another guy who came in when he was a teenager or came in when he was 18.
Well, yeah, obviously.
That would be correct.
Why am I drawing a blank here? We're going to feel really dumb because
you are
not active,
feel dumb.
Right?
Active.
Active?
Kevin Durant.
Kevin Durant is the other one.
There you go.
Now, the interesting thing is the guy that Luka passed is actually a guy who did not come in as a teenager, who is retired. Not Wilt. Played same position, though.
Shaq.
That would be the guy, Shaq.
Yeah.
About 50 days younger than Shaq.
So, you know, obviously the Wilt numbers are ridiculous. And I did a little stat head search today on 60-20 games, 60 points, 20 rebounds. There's been 33 of them in NBA history.
Was Will have 26?
28.
Will have 32? Oh, 28. I thought it might be 32.
No, he had 28. Elgin Baylor had two.
Yeah,
George
I remember
Mikan
Elgin
had
Baylor.
One. Shaq had one, and then Luka last night. And Wilt had one. Wilt had a 78.43 rebound performance in a loss. He played 63 minutes in triple overtime. I mean, just the numbers are insane.
Yeah, that's a game.
All right. You mentioned Booker. Bad news today for the Phoenix Suns. It's been a season of a lot bad news for them, although we'll see about their new ownership. Devin Booker out at least a month with a groin injury. Had a hamstring. Mm-hmm. Came back, then aggravated a groin. I don't know if it's related, but when you see two injuries come like that back to back, you are inclined to believe there's some relationship. And then he comes back on Christmas Day, plays 4 minutes, re-aggravates the groin, and now he's out a month. In and of itself, you're just a little bit, you know, Booker is a guy who pushes to play fast, wants to play. And, who knows? It might have cost him here. Obviously, he wants to play in a Christmas Day game. But the thing about a groin injury like this, I know from just covering folks, especially when you re-aggravate it, it just becomes such a thing that has the potential to linger for so long. We remember this with LeBron when he first got to the Lakers. It basically bothered him the rest of the season. So my guess here is that the Suns are like, look, we don't even want you to even think about it for a month. We're not even going to talk about it for a month, regardless of where it might be. It's a blow for them because, by the way, they just had.
Well, I think it's going to be located like at the top of his leg, the groin.
it's a blow for them after they had a really good win over Memphis on Tuesday night. They just played a great team, high energy game.
Got a little payback game.
Yeah, after Memphis strutted on them, whipping them by 25.
After they had a hell of a performance Sunday night, another great game against Denver, lost that one in overtime too, on the road.
So they did play. So obviously, Cam Johnson is out, still out, coming back from knee surgery. Campaigns.
Jay Crowder remains
injury issues.
Invisible. Yeah.
So, look, I mean, the benefit that they have is that the West is jammed up together, like. If they play okay basketball, but you got to figure that Chris Paul is going to miss some more games with injury.
And I would say you say that's the benefit. I would say that's also the jeopardy. It's like, dude,
yep.
You know, they're sitting in fifth place. They're only a game and a half above ninth.
Like, I think
they don't have to play 600 basketball to stay in the playoff race is my point.
Well, yeah. they're three and a half games ahead of 11th where Minnesota is. And they got a brutal schedule ahead of them.
Yeah, I will say this. Minnesota obviously is scuffling and Towns is out for a while longer. You know, Golden State's in 10th. Golden State, despite also just kicking the Grizzlies' ass and letting them know all about it, Golden State's obviously in for a tough go here for at least the next couple of weeks without Steph. So you've got that. But go on, Bontemps.
Well, no, just that this is their upcoming schedule. They're on a road trip right now. They got Washington that'll be last night by the time this posts. Then they're in Toronto. They're in New York. They're in Cleveland. None of those are easy. Then they come home. They play Miami, Cleveland. Then they play Golden State, Denver, Minnesota, Memphis, Brooklyn. Like, that's a tough stretch of games. And that's before you get into games against Memphis, Dallas, Toronto again at the end of the month. Like, that, they're not a lot of gimmies there for a team that's got a lot of injuries. So, yeah, like, they don't have to play 700 ball to stay with the teams in the West. But if they have a bad month, they could be fighting for 10th.
I was going to say, but if they play 300 ball, then it's problematic. Yeah. And they're 2-5 without Booker this season. You know, if you want to throw in the Denver loss, that would be 2-6. Now, to your point, hey, you got to throw more on Chris Paul when you're trying to go in the other direction there.
Right.
I mean, at some point, you've got to make a deal with Jay Crowder just to get bodies, just to get rotation players.
Well, a few things on the Jay Crowder front. Number one, the Suns have a very high standard when it comes to doing transactions. They have had very good transactions under James Jones, but
trades, not high standard in the draft, just trades.
Well, yeah, they've had some wins in the draft, but they've had some losses, but that's true. Dwayne Washington has been a good draft pick for them, the guy they drafted this year. So, anyway,
Washington wasn't a draft pick there, Chief. It wasn't a draft pick, but go on.
Sorry, I did not mean to derail. I just meant to take a little jab.
I thought he was a draft pick. I'm sorry.
No, he was not.
I was just poking a little bit. My bad. Go on, Wendy. High standard for transactions.
Anyway, it's hard. It's challenging to do trade business with the Suns. Teams will tell you that they are, you know, there's some teams where you see them make a lot of trade transactions. The Suns are not one of them. And that's play that with Jay Crowder. Now, on the Jay Crowder front, one of the issues is that there isn't a straight up trade the Suns have liked for him. So they've tried to do these three team trades. Mm-hmm. You'll always hear me say that the three team trades and no team trade. Obviously they happen, but for every one that happens, 500 died on the table. Right. It's just, it, you know, they may have to lower their standard. Another thing is that, you know, Jay Crowder is a older player who wants a contract and, you know, some teams are nervous about that. So that's, you know, been a, you know, an impediment as well. So
yeah, they may I love Jay. I like him a lot. I just don't understand how he thinks this is helping increase his values. An upcoming free agent.
I think everybody's at fault here. Cause I'm sorry. If you're the Suns, I have not understood their stance from the beginning on this. And this goes along with what they did with DeAndre Ayton, where whether it's Monty Williams or James Jones or the group together, they have not done, in my opinion, a very good job of mending fences in situations like this. Like, they needed to go to Jay Crowder in the summer if they were going to do this thing where they were going to have Cam Johnson start. You got to go sit him down and say, listen, man, we know you're not happy about this. We get that. If you want to try to get somewhere else, that's fine. We'll work with you on it. But we need to have you on the court. You need to be part of what we're doing. And let's go win a championship. If you do that, you're going to get paid, whether it's by us or somebody else. Like, you got to go do that work and get that guy on the court. Somehow, some way, you got to find a way to do it. Same thing with DeAndre Ayton. We saw the stuff come back up the other day. Him getting into it with Mikal Bridges and with Monty Williams again. And like, that goes back to the summer. They basically just said, whatever, we'll deal with this guy later.
Like, you know, they've been, Ayton is getting yelled at for 5 years.
I understand.
But and Bridges is, did publicly take the blame on that, and he basically said, "Hey, I was out of line."
I get it. I'm not saying that it's all.
But you're right. They did not handle the Ayton situation. It was not smoothed over by the time training camp started.
There's been a lot of bad vibes.
Well, it's just a lot of like basically saying like whatever. We're not going to worry. We're not going to deal with this. And like,
so
I just don't understand how you're going to get through the through a season like this, where you're just repeatedly doing the same thing over and over again in these types of situations.
My perception, having been around the Suns a little bit, almost more than any other team in the last couple of years, that team has got a lot of reps together. Those core guys have a lot of reps together. And so they have there's like a laundry list of things that they've overcome. And so they are a little bit more prone to bickering because they know they can get over it. But also Monty Williams' style, while he does have a very well-respected leadership style where he can put his arm around a player, there's also times where Monty can just kind of be stubborn and be like, this is how I'm handling it. I don't care what I'm trying to be diplomatic here. And also James Jones, the way he operates as an executive, he can be very stubborn. Like they get on their position and they stick to it.
Yeah.
That's what happened with DeAndre Ayton in that negotiations. That's what happened with, the negotiations that they had with Cameron Johnson, that they just didn't get a deal done. It's happened with the Jay Crowder trade negotiations. And like even the trade, the biggest trade that he made was the Chris Paul trade.
Yep.
That took a month plus of negotiating with the Thunder. Mm-hmm. It was the off season. It hadn't gotten public. It got public right at the end. And that was a trade that was a grand slam for the Suns, and the Thunder were very happy with it, considering where they were. And that took a month. So the Suns have a lot of victories in their win column, but they're a little bit stubborn in the way they do business. So
no question. And I certainly agree. Like they've had a ton of success. There's no question this group's had a ton of success across the board. But like to McMahon's point, they've been playing this whole season already down a core rotation guy, and their bench already wasn't good enough last year. And so now you've subtracted Jay Crowder from the situation. You haven't replaced him. You're now 2.5 months into the season. You've got an old team already, led by Chris Paul, but a bunch of older guys that have played a ton of minutes in recent years that you're leaning on. You know, Devin Booker, like you said, has played through a ton of injuries. Bobby Marks tweeted out earlier, he's not an older player, but he's had, I think, 4 or 5 either hamstring or, you know, muscle type injuries in the past year and a half. Like you probably need to have some more depth to give him some more time off, even if he doesn't want it. And they just kind of keep doing the same thing and running into the same wall over and over again. I'm not sure where that's going to get him in the long term.
Well, they have Crowder, they have all their draft picks, you know, they have the ammunition to do something. Now their acting governor, Sam Garvin, who's in this weird spot. He was already in a weird spot when he took over for Robert Sarver. And now he's in a super weird spot because technically he has to make decisions, but now the team is in the process of a sale. He gave an interview before the sale was announced to the Arizona Republic, where he said that it was James Jones's call and his decision on paying Jay Crowder and just letting him stay home. That was obviously Crowder's desire, but he wanted to make it clear that that wasn't an ownership thing. So, you know, I don't know what that's worth, but I will say, like, having covered teams that are in the middle of a sales process and also having sort of toe in the water about the situation in Phoenix, it's a challenging time right now. Especially when you're not sure what the new boss is going to want to do. You're not sure who the new boss is going to want to bring in. And it's hard enough for the Suns to finish a negotiation in normal times. It's extremely hard for them to also maybe run it through, an acting governor who's not supposed to have communication with Sarver. I don't know. And then the new ownership I don't know, man. It's a challenge.
The other hard part from the beginning has always been that with a Jay Crowder trade, they're trying to trade him and get back guys that can help him win. And the teams right. that are trading for him are trying to
they
add
need
to
wings.
The,
That's
well,
right.
no, but I'm saying the teams that want Jay Crowder are good teams and aren't going to be like, yeah, we'll give you another good wing player for Jay Crowder. Yeah. Like that. Normally a guy like that's available. Like, hey, you can trade him for a pick. Like the Suns aren't looking for picks.
Yeah. We've also heard, possibly, Dario Saric, he's also on an expiring contract. Yeah. Could be available. And trade. All right. We'll monitor the Suns. now the Nets play.
Might want to fill their 15th roster spot. That's been open all season at some point too. I don't know whose decision that is.
Well, there's not. It's one of the things that you hear about when coming out of the G League showcase with all the two-way guys yeah. that exist in the league. There's just not, there's not a plethora of available rotation players.
Hey, Chris Paul's got Carmelo's number.
Yeah, there's probably somebody they could find though to fill that spot and play some minutes right now when they're down 17 guys.
Is there former Michigan State guy who's available?
Look around. I want to discuss the Brooklyn Nets, and they're playing against the Hawks tonight, Wednesday night. I don't know what's going to happen in that game, so let's acknowledge that. The way this pod goes, they'll probably get
here comes the windy curse.
Even though the Hawks are banged up right now and just got hammered by the Pacers last night. So on November 25th, the Nets lost to fall to 9-11. Since that time to the recording of this pod, they've played 14 games, of which they have won 13 of them.
That seems pretty good.
I want to go over some things that have been happening in this stretch. This is the type of basketball that we envisioned with the Nets when Durant and Kyrie got together, and certainly when they got Harden and, mm-hmm. For a while showed off one of the best offensive attacks that we've seen in the modern time. So they're number one in offense in the last 14 games, which is, not stunning, but I want to go over and tell you some numbers. You know that like mm-hmm. the holy grail for offensive basketball is 50, 40, 90. There's only been a few dozen players.
I see where you're going with this one.
In the NBA history to do it. Well, in the stretch of 14 games, Durant is 61% overall, 45% mm-hmm. from three, mm-hmm. 95% from the line. And here's how close Kyrie is. Mm-hmm. Kyrie's 50% from the field. I think 49 and change. I'm giving him a
49.8.
40% from three
mm-hmm.
and 89% from the line. So essentially they have two 50, 40, 90 performers performing at the same time. Okay.
Wendy, not only that, their team during that stretch, 53 and change from the floor, 42.1 from three-point range, and 80.4 from the free throw line. So they're 53, 42, 80 as a team. Now, obviously, that's primarily because the two guys you just pointed to who are averaging 31 points and 27 points per game during that stretch.
Exactly. So let me go over two other things here. Number one, I want to talk about clutch play. Because nine times in this 14-game stretch, they've entered clutch time. Inside 5 minutes, inside 5 points. They've come out of those with 8 wins. 8-1 going into clutch time. In the clutch as a team, they are shooting 62% in clutch time, 46% on threes. Durant, 61% field goal percentage in clutch time in this stretch, 75% on threes. I'll say that again, 75% on threes. We're not talking about two games. We're talking about over nine games, okay? Kyrie, clutch time, 55% in this stretch, 33% from the field. Now, I'm going to jump in front of Bontemps here because for the last 2 years, every time we've ever talked about the Nets, whether they're doing well or poorly, Bontemps points to their defense. And he does that for a good reason because their defense has been the weight on their ankle.
Steal my thunder, bro.
It's been the urine-soaked wet blanket on their championship hopes.
I was going to praise their defense being better.
All right, so in this stretch, they're number 10 in defense. So top 10 defense. But this is what I want to point out. Nick Claxton, who has his limitations as a defender because of his slight build, in clutch time defense. And look, we're talking about 9 games. We're not talking about 37 games.
Well, we're talking games. About a 24-minute sample, to be clear.
Okay. Not still. Everything, but not nothing.
It's a whole half.
Okay.
Or half of a whole.
But it's in 9 different games. It wasn't on one night. Okay.
Sure.
His defensive rating is 55. In other words, if it was projected over 100 possessions, the other team would score 55 points. Now, I'll let you go, Bontemps. I just want to point out that this is an incredible stretch of basketball. And this is Durant and Kyrie, the dream level that we've been looking at. There's no way they're going to continue to shoot the ball this way. There's no way they're going to continue to play this ball in the clutch. But we were all over this team for their deficiencies. And so now we have to pay attention to them when it's coming together.
Yeah. I mean, look, they've been on a great stretch. And the biggest criticism, I wouldn't even say criticism, the biggest question you had about this Nets team was they were generally beating teams that aren't very good during this stretch. Right, that basically all were games against teams that are currently at or below 500. The exception to that was when they played the Celtics and they lost in fairly handy fashion at home at the beginning of December. But then they play Milwaukee on Friday. I was at that game. They played really well from start to finish, controlled that game, won going away against the Bucks. They go to Cleveland on Monday, another good team, control that game for basically the entire game, win that game going away. And that really puts that question to bed for now. And yeah, I mean, the thing that stood out to me, I mean, look, like I said, I'm not saying the stuff about the 24 minutes to knock the Nets in the clutch. I just think we talk a lot about clutch stats and it's about such a microscopic sample size that it doesn't matter to me almost whether teams are good or bad in them. Cause you're talking about such a little. I mean, yes, in the aggregate, if you're winning all these games, yes, it matters. But if you're talking about 24 minutes over a 20-game sample or 15-game sample size, it's just a very small amount. To me,
NBA playoff series are played over 7 games. So, I mean,
sure.
I'm not saying I'm ready to give Nick Claxton a max contract. I'm just saying, like, it's over 9 different nights that they were in the clutch.
Sure. The bigger thing I would take away from it is the first 20 games of the season. Yeah, there were 9-11. The first 20 games of the season, the Nets were 20th in defense. The last 14 games, they're 10th in defense. If the Nets are 10th in defense going forward, they're going to be really damn good. Like that's the biggest question. The two questions they have are, can they be a top 10 defensive team? And how long could Kevin Durant go playing heavy minutes and never missing a game? The one game he missed was the game he sat out when they sat their whole team in Indiana, sat their top 8 guys and won the game anyway. It was a really, talk to people around the Nets. That was a really galvanizing win for that team, going to Indiana back to back, winning that game. And, they've gone on a huge run since then. And by the way, Jacques Vaughn deserves a lot of credit too. Like you look at what's happened with this team, he took over as coach and early on there was a game where Kyrie wasn't, was kind of freelancing on a play. Jacques Vaughn immediately called timeout and was like, we're not going to do that. We're going to run our stuff. And like, you look at the way this team has turned their season around. He deserves a lot of credit because this team does not resemble the team they were early on when they were flailing around, getting blown out, looking.
I also think
terrible.
Kyrie is absolutely without question, purposely on his best behavior.
Sure.
And he's
also been available and healthy. Look, set aside the controversy from earlier this year, this goes back to the summer. From the moment that guy opted into his final year of his deal, he has been available and showing up for games and healthy and not missing games for nagging injuries. Like he clearly sees that he's got to be on the court and produce to get paid. And so he's doing that. And if him and Kevin are on the court healthy and playing, their offense is going to be really good. And if their defense could stay where it's been for the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks, they've got every reason to be one of the elite teams in the East, which, certainly not what I think any of us expected to be saying after the way things started out over the first month.
Well, and then if they continue to be one of the elite teams in the East, it sets up, it's going to be an interesting summer regardless. But, you know, if this is the way the Nets play for the rest of the season, they make a deep playoff run. How can you not keep Kyrie?
Well, that's a whole other debate. The other thing too is
how can you not keep Kyrie and convince KD that it makes any sense in the world?
Well, and the other thing that, you know, our conversation about the straw poll got aggregated a little bit in the wrong way when we talked about Durant.
You don't say.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I didn't, what I said at the time was because of the combination of where the Nets I thought were going to be in the standings and the fact that narratively I thought Durant was going to have some headwind against them based off what's going on with the Nets, I didn't think he had much of a chance of winning. Now, if the Nets finish with the best record in the Eastern Conference and Kevin is healthy the rest of the year playing like this, he's going to be right in the mix on the MVP race, just like these other guys are. So,
by the way, some of the gambling sites, KD is now number 5 in the odds at plus 1,000, right above Embiid. I haven't compared their stats side by side. Perhaps somebody could do that for us on social media. But Luka is once again the favorite after last night. Obviously, this is a reaction to last night. So, in order, Luka, Tatum, Jokic, who is absolutely incredible.
It was also Giannis, first after KD, Sunday, and too. And Jokic was first after Sunday. I mean, this is the way it's going to be for a while. But my point is, like, Durant, if the Nets are going to keep doing this and they're going to be top 2 or 3 seed in the East, which they're, I think, a game out now of first, like, he's going to be right in the mix for that, too. I certainly did not think that the Nets are going to be able to turn things around like this. But those two games against Milwaukee and Cleveland were really impressive. And that was, like I said, the one lingering question for me was, what were they going to do against higher level competition? And those were two of the more impressive wins, you know, in the last couple of weeks around the league. Yeah. So I'm impressed with what they've been able to do. It's a hell of a turnaround.
The Nets are playing as well as anybody in the league right now. And it's really remarkable how they've been able to overcome the presence of Nick Friedell and go on this kind of a run.
I'm just glad that Nick's, out of the drama for at least a few weeks.
Okay, don't put the Wendy curse on that.
Yes.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
Throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All right, before we go, I would like to speak about one of the hottest teams in the league that we never talk about. It's partially my fault. Part of it is the nature of things that we can't control. And that is the Western Conference leading, at least as the time of this pod, Denver Nuggets.
Who have It's won all five your in fault because this is the Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst. So don't partially your fault, nothing.
Well, okay, you're right.
It's your fault.
Partially is, they're not in a high volume market. They've won 8 out of 10, five in a row. Jokic is absolutely having a brilliant season. And with his...
Pains you to say that.
It does not. I voted for him for MVP that. 2 years ago. I don't know if you heard. He is now up to 9.5 assists per game as we keep an eye on the possibility of him averaging a triple-double. Mm-hmm. And when you watch him play... what you see, the other thing is, this is one thing that, he's always shot the ball at a high efficiency from the field, but he is shooting 62% this year. And it has almost become a math problem now when you watch him play. You can see teams struggle. Should we double team him or not? Because when he gets the ball in the mid post, and he has his array of different things that he can do. I mean, he is shooting on shots from the mid range. He is shooting 65% And when you get down inside around the basket, he's shooting almost 75%. So the natural thing is, my God, we can't let this guy pick us apart. We got to send a double team. But then he just destroys you because
you can't. It's like you can't double team him.
Yep.
He's too good.
But here's what I want to talk about with the Nuggets. The Nuggets, and I know the Bontemps is about to attack me here. The Nuggets are the number one clutch defensive team in the league. Number one.
But overall, defensively, number like
23. Right.
And not only that, yeah, but they've been bad defensively generally for 5 years, you know, for as long as I can remember. Actually, that's not true. They improved last year. They were better last year. Mm-hmm. But they have had periods of really poor defense. And yet when it matters in clutch situations, they're awesome. And you look at their guy, you know, you look at the prime lineup that they put out there when they need to basically get stops at the end of games, which is basically Jokic, Aaron Gordon, Bruce Brown, and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, depending on who has been healthy. You know, obviously sometimes you're going to have Jamal Murray in there. They've had Bones Highland in there, depending on who's healthy. But that has been the core group. And they get stops in the clutch. And they have a guy who is a devastating half-court offensive player. Now, they have some bad losses this year. You know,
you want to know who the second best defensive team in clutch time is this year, by the way?
Oh, USWB. Who is it?
Probably Brooklyn.
No, it's the Houston Rockets.
Well, they're never
across
in
seven. I mean, across, clearly, they've actually been in 17 clutch games and they played six less clutch minutes than Denver has this year. So,
ooh, Wendy, he's taken some shots.
So are you saying that the team that's got the best record in the Western Conference, albeit narrowly, them who has a suspect defense, them able to defend in the clutch is not a relevant thing to bring up?
I think it's a lot more relevant that they're 23rd in defense. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I will say if there are exceptions, but typically the net rating, the point differential, those things are much better indicators of playoff success than clutch dominance. Now, sometimes teams have both of those things in their favor, but
it's obviously not a bad. It's obviously not a bad thing to have a good numbers in clutch moments at the end of games. I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm a little more focused on the fact that over the course of the season, they've been a bad defensive team. And I think Denver's going to have the best record in the West. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. They still have played. I think only Portland has played less home games than them. They're, I believe, first now in the Doug Moe reverse standings, which you've talked about before. I think they're ahead of Boston. Over the course of the season, and they're going to win a ton of home games. But as far as looking at them as a championship contending team, I worry about their defense. I think their defense has to be better. So I am more concerned about that than encouraged by what they're doing.
I agree with you. I think if you're going to say something about the Nuggets, it's their defense. And I'm just saying it's interesting that they can get stops in the clutch. They have.
By the way, Michael Porter Jr., there are definitely times when he has not played in the clutch, and obviously he missed a stretch of games. Small sample size theater, though. They are plus 30 in 31 clutch minutes with him on the floor.
That only bolsters Bontemps' point.
Well, yeah,
he was getting hunted in that game Sunday by Chris Paul.
And I do think come playoff time, especially, I'm pretty sure Michael Malone's going to lean into going with Bruce Brown, putting his best defensive lineup out there. But, you know.
Well, and that was the interesting thing. To what you said, Brian, when you talk about those clutch lineups, that to me is the fascinating question with Denver, because you didn't say Michael Porter Jr., right? You said Jokic, Aaron Gordon.
Well, he's just been hurt so much.
Bruce Brown. I understand. But my point is he's on a max contract. You would assume Michael Porter Jr. is going to be out there. But to me, if you're looking at their team, you could make a decent argument that if you're in the last 5 minutes of a game, you'd rather have Aaron Gordon, KCP, and Bruce Brown out there with Jokic and Jamal Murray than having Michael Porter Jr. out there. And that's going to be a real rub question for Michael Malone. Like, what is the choice is going to be in those moments? What are the choices going to be in those moments? Because you know, if you have him just getting targeted at the other end, if you have those three guys out there spacing the floor for a Murray Jokic pick and roll, your offense is probably going to be pretty good. So it really becomes, what do you do at the other end? That's just a fascinating question with that team.
What did they sign Bruce Brown for?
1 year for the tax MLE.
God.
Great signing.
He'd still be a good fit on the Nets. I did not understand why the Nets didn't keep him. That was bizarre to me. Well, like, he's a flawed player, obviously. His offense is not a great shooter. But like, you have him on a team like this with Jokic, with his ability to kick.
Well, that's the thing.
To cut, like, he's a perfect fit in Denver.
He can defend so many different positions, you know, and he's, you know, so, I mean, the thing is they signed Claxton, who's playing well, for 2 years and 20. They re-signed Patty Mills. And they just had to draw the line somewhere, I guess.
Also, you say he's not a great shooter. He's not a high volume shooter, but he's 39.8% from three on the highest volume of his career. He was 40.4% on very low volume, admittedly, last year.
Well, you know, I say not a great shooter, to your point. I mean, he's not a guy that defenses are going to respect from three. He's become better and shown ability to hit those shots, but he's not a guy teams are flying out to contest. They'll live with him shooting those shots.
Yeah, and he can also
people in Denver run will that tell funky you
pick and roll where he's the roll man with Jokic and make plays out of the roll.
He's a perfect. I mean, I said the moment they signed him this summer, I'd love the fit there. It's a great fit. He was a really good fit in Brooklyn. He just has to be on a team that could take advantage of his skill set and not sacrifice at the other end. Which is, I mean, look, you talk about the end of playoff games, like you said, McMahon. I think you can make a really good argument. Bruce Brown is going to win them more playoff games than Michael Porter Jr., which opens up a lot of questions about Michael Porter Jr.
Well, people in Denver will tell you that Porter has improved incrementally defensively.
And what they'll also tell you is that, hey, he is trying. He wants to get it right there. He's not just, you know, mailing it in on that in the floor, which is a significant improvement.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, Michael Malone really raved about his buy-in. And him, of course, he said, hey, he's never going to be Scottie Pippen, but, you know, he's making multiple efforts. You know, he's diving on the floor. He's trying to, you know, really paying attention to game plan and stuff. So
what they would love for him to do is just act 6'10". challenge shots, you know, get in a defensive stance. You know, make it somewhat hard to get around you. So, because, you know, you got long arms so that the people can behind you. Just act 6'10 is what they would love for him to do.
And the ultimate question there, too, is just are you going to ultimately be able to get where you want to go if you have him and Jokic out there in high leverage playoff games at that end of the court? Like,
I'm just saying to you, you can shoot holes in it all you want, and you may be 1,000,000,000% correct. In clutch time, they're defending better than anybody else.
And Aaron Gordon has been absolutely
awesome
this year.
He has been phenomenal.
So they have Aaron Gordon, they have Bruce Brown, and they have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope.
That's what I'm saying. I like that group.
Okay, they have DeAndre Jordan.
We got him in again.
I'm just pointing out guys they have on the roster.
The bit continues. It's great. Well, I just think interesting.
Is Bob Pettit, did he have a 60-20 game?
They're just in a really interesting spot because I think they've got a great chance to win the West. They've got Jokic playing out of his mind. Jamal Murray is incrementally getting better. I think by the time we get to the playoffs, he'll look a lot better than he does today as he gets more of the rust off after missing so much time. But it's just a defense question. And you know, again, if you've got Bruce Brown sitting there and you could put him in, have Michael Porter Jr. chilling on the bench, that might erase some of the defense questions, which, you know, you got a guy in a max. It's just usually not the conversation you're having.
Speaking of the Nuggets, and before we go, Mark Warkentin, who was an executive in the NBA for, I think, around 30 years, 25 years, passed away this last week. He worked for a number of teams, worked for the Blazers for a long time, worked for the Cavs, worked for the Knicks, and he was a general manager of the Denver Nuggets and won executive of the year as the Denver Nuggets. An extremely influential person to me and so many other executives, known as Steiny to his friends. Not only that, but was basically Jerry Tarkanian's fixer, getting players.
I was going to say that was the maybe the most memorable part of his
general manager of UNLV.
Yeah,
those guys got some great NIL deals.
Oh my God, did he tell me some stories about UNLV? And I want to tell you that probably four or five. He was a political junkie. And after he, you know, he sort of got into the consultant phase of his career, he basically, anyway, I won't go into that, but he told me so many stories that I cannot tell about what they did at UNLV to get players eligible. It involved police and the judicial system, is all I'm going to say, more than just buying guys off, and might have involved congressmen at one point.
By eligible, you meant allowed to leave.
Yeah, like I definitely heard stories about judges and congressmen getting involved with helping UNLV players. I won't go into more than that. And he was a political junkie, and I was trying to convince him to let me write a book about his experiences and change all the names. And I even bought and sent him a this is 4 or 5 years ago, a copy of the book Primary Colors, which was a book that was written about basically the Bill Clinton campaign in 1992, but changed all the names. They later made it a movie. John Travolta played the Clinton character. And I just said, Mark, we'll change all the names. People won't know who you're talking about, but the stories are so unbelievable. You know, he used to say one of the big things he learned in Vegas was that, cash tells no stories. He didn't say it that way. He said it a more artfully way, you know, cash leaves no paper trail or something like that. But it was more artfully said than that. One time he was trying to find a player that the team he was working with was trying to sign, but they couldn't find them. This is like in the early 2000s when not everybody had a cell phone, they would answer, but they wanted to sign a player, and he knew he was a big gambler. And so he went to the place where he gambled, which happened to be a golf course. And the way he found him was to go to all the golf courses in the guy's hometown and look for the car that he knew the college boosters at his college bought for him. And he found the guy's car in the parking lot, got a car from the pro shop, and just started driving around the course saying, hey, have any of you guys seen a 6'8" guy on this golf course? And they go, yeah, he's over on the 13th hole. He found him. All right. Literally, that is the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg of the stories that Mark Warfentine had. He was also an incredibly, he worked with so many executives. He handed me in 2005 a proposal for the play-in tournament. It wasn't called the play-in tournament. His was called Make Every Game Count. So he was proposing that, you know, 15 years before it was implemented. So anyway, Mark Warfentine.
Also a guy, I didn't have the pleasure getting to know him. Certainly Brian has known him for a long time, but you know, anybody who's noticed over the past few days since he passed away, there's been a ton of acknowledgement of him from all across the basketball community. And everybody basically said he's an awesome guy who had awesome stories. And, you know, kind of Brian's summed
really
them up, I think, by
starting to feel my mortality here, losing Paul Silas, who was a coach who taught me so much about the NBA game. And now Mark Warfentine, an executive who taught me a lot about, well, I wouldn't say he taught me about the NBA game. He taught me about the realities of the way the basketball world works.
Well, sounds like the NBA game to me.
Yeah. And a wonderful, wonderful man. Lived in Portland last 10 years of his life. Always went to see him. He had this barbecue joint that he would go to. He would make me drive down to Lake Oswego. Who thinks of going to barbecue joint Lake Oswego? But he had some barbecue joint they like to go to. I would go meet him down there. He drove the same car when he was the general manager of the Denver Nuggets. Now the Nuggets aren't known for paying that highly, but you know, he did pretty well. He drove like a Toyota and he was still driving it like 10 years later. Total, total scout by nature. Anyway, I've gone on too long, but Mark Warfentine, you will be missed. And thank you for everything. His daughter, I believe, is involved in the basketball business. So I hope him and his family are doing okay. And my condolences, and thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. Hope your holiday season is going well. Thank you to Bontemps. Thank you to McMahon. Thank you to Bruce and Jackson, who are working for us during their holiday break or holiday time here. We will talk to you next week when hopefully we'll be getting back to a regular schedule.
2023.
Adios, amigos.
You stepped on his adios, amigos, Bontemps.
Well, I was just saying, it's 2023. Big deal.
Thanks for pointing that out, Bontemps.